You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
No, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host, Andrew McComb. There's nothing like a special event to bring out the worst of the scammers. Whether it be credit card details, bank details, or identity theft, there's plenty of it about at the moment, mostly thanks to the Olympic Games. More so than at any other time in internet history, spam is up, identity theft is the opening story of mainstream media, and crooks and shonks are lurking behind the most benign emails. According to the latest quarterly Secure Computer Internet Threats Report, around 150 spam messages are sent out every day, up 280% from the same time last year. Volumes peaked on the 27th of March this year, with 185 billion spam messages being sent in just one day. In an attempt to appeal to a wider audience, spammers are now moving into languages. Previously, almost all spam messages were in English, but now half of all the spam messages are in other languages, with Japanese and German being popular alternatives. Malware is the scourge of the internet. Normally delivered via email or installed by just visiting unscrupulous websites, malware authors try to trick you into installing their insidious programs on your computer, so that they can collect information about you, your identity, such as your bank details and passwords. They may even want to turn your computer into a zombie so that they can send their wares via your computer. Malware purveyors have embraced the Olympic Games wholeheartedly. Recent outbreaks and attacks are attempting to lure victims with the promise of news and information on the Beijing Games, and researchers only see the trend increasing over the coming weeks. One of the most recent attacks is specifically targeting national sporting organisations and athletic representative groups. The attacks are disguised as a dispatch from the IOC and contain a Trojan hidden as a PDF press release. According to security firm Message Labs, the content of the attack may have been lifted directly from an official IOC document. When the malicious attachment is launched, the user is infected with the Trojan that logs and updates sensitive data. The use of supposedly official documents has been a favourite technique for targeted spear phishing attacks. Similar attacks have been attempted to spoof the US Internal Revenue Service and Department of Justice. Researchers are predicting that the trend will only get worse, so be prepared. Don't click those links in emails, even if you know who they're from. Cut and paste them into your browser only if you trust the source. Spend $60 and buy yourself a damn good internet security product that tells you what it's doing. And tell others who share your computer to be on their guard. Follow these simple steps and your details will remain just that, your personal details, and surfing will continue to be an enjoyable experience for you and the entire family.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Google takes to the road. Spam, spam and more spam, with a bit of malware thrown in for good measure. A Microsoft-free desktop in a worldwide market is on the table. Jobs makes a boo-boo. And Mozilla looks at consolidating messages into one application. First up, though, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk News Desk.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Google comes down to earth in Australia, People Telecom to be the first to resell Telstra's ADSL2 broadband, Live Mesh Tech Preview opens up to Aussies, the federal government announces the deadline for the national broadband network tenders, and be sure to think before you click during the 2008 Beijing Olympics. This is Tech Talk News. In the United States this week, 11 people from 5 different countries have been charged with the biggest identity theft and computer hacking case in American history. The cyber criminals allegedly hacked into wireless computer networks of 9 American retailers, stealing more than 40 million credit card and debit card numbers. US prosecutors allege that the numbers were then sold over the internet to other criminals. The retail hacking ring was first revealed in March last year. The alleged ringleader is a US citizen, Albert Gonzalez. Michael Sullivan is a US attorney for the District of Massachusetts, and he says that the hackers used a technique called war driving.
War driving is simply driving around in a car with a laptop computer looking for accessible wireless computer networks. According to the indictment, Gonzalez and his co-conspirators did just this. And once they located a wireless network, they hacked into it.
And once inside the computer network, the cyber criminals installed what are called sniffer programs.
Sniffers are programs that capture communications over computer networks as the program moved through the retailer's credit and debit processing networks. This allowed the defendants to remotely capture sensitive information, such as the card numbers, passwords, and account information.
The alleged ringleader, Albert Gonzalez, is in custody in New York and faces life in jail if he's convicted of all the charges. Google has launched its controversial Street View mapping tool in Australia amid a backlash against the feature by privacy activists around the world. Street View, accessed from the Google website, lets people explore the country at ground level for the first time with little more than a computer and an internet connection. Google-branded Holden Astra cars with roof-mounted cameras began traversing our streets about November last year, taking tens of millions of detailed panoramic street-level photos. Most Australian coastal cities and many regional and outback towns are covered, but there are some notable omissions, such as Uluru. Google Maps product manager Andrew Foster said more images would be added to Street View in the coming months as they are processed by the search engine juggernaut. Street View was launched in the US in May last year and has since expanded to parts of France and Italy. Google's camera-equipped cars have also been spotted in New Zealand, Britain, Germany, Spain, Ireland, the Czech Republic, Japan, Switzerland, and Norway. Mid-tier telco People Telecom today said it would soon start selling ADSL2 Plus broadband services based on Telstra's wholesale platform, making it the first telco to do so. Telstra has, for the past several years, demonstrated an unwillingness to wholesale ADSL2 Plus services to other telcos as it does ADSL1, as rivals like iiNet and Optus are speedily rolling out their own ADSL2 Plus networks. However, the nation's former monopolist has appeared to change its tune over the past several months. Telstra has the largest ADSL2 Plus network in Australia, touching some 900 telephone exchanges. People Telecom is already an extensive reseller of Telstra services and inked a $200 million deal earlier this year with the bigger telco. Microsoft has opened up its much-anticipated live mesh technology preview for Australians for the first time. The technology, when completed, will provide a way for people to synchronise information across a mesh of devices, including desktop and notebook PCs, Mac and smartphones. Details of Mac and mobile phone synchronization capabilities are yet to be announced. Harvey Sanchez is Microsoft's online services leader here in Australia and spoke to Tech Talk Radio recently.
Microsoft Live Mesh is basically a new service that Microsoft just announced. But basically what Live Mesh does, if you think about your digital world today and you think about the type of devices that you might have and the type of data that you might have in different types of devices, it basically allows you to really unify all of those devices together into your own personal mesh. So, for example, if you have, you know, a PC at home and a PC in the office and a media device or a music device or you might have a mobile phone and you've got data spread across all of those devices, well, with the power of the internet, you have the ability to integrate those all together. So, for example, if I wanted to share documents that's sitting on one machine, I'll be able to get access to those documents from whatever device I might have inside my mesh.
Aussies with a Windows Live ID can now use their login to participate in the technology preview, which was previously only open to US residents. The deadline has now been set for the National Broadband Network tender process. Telcos in the running for the $4.7 billion National Broadband Network have 2 more weeks to finalise and hand over the network information needed for the tender process. Acting Communications Minister Anthony Albanese released the final draft documents a few days ago, setting the deadline for the end of the working day on the 22nd of August. Once the government receives and verifies all of the required information, bidders will have 12 weeks to finalise and submit their proposals. Telstra claims it's ahead of the game, having submitted all of its information last Monday, though the government has yet to confirm if the submission is complete. Finally this week, the Beijing Olympic Games is now underway, and security experts have sent out an 11th-hour warning to internet users. Think twice before you click. Mark Hoffman from the US-based SANS Institute said in an advisory last week that it should be common knowledge by now that the next few weeks are going to be rife with attempts to phish, spam and scam users with the Olympic theme. In essence, he said that malicious campaigns will all ask recipients to click, so it's probably a good idea to remind users of the dangers of the almighty click. Furthermore, today, security vendor McAfee sent out advisory warning of the high-level sophistication spammers, phishers and malware writers use. The vendor warns users to take precautions when surfing the web for news, widgets or applications related to the Olympics. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
And here we are again. Olympic organisers have announced that everyone attending the opening ceremony
is going to be microchipped.
Basically, the system was first used for international bidding on coffee crops, would you believe?
Don't you need a SIM card in the phone?
Not to take pictures, no.
No?
And you can SMS them to the emergency operators too.
Good. Oh, that's great.
That's probably a reasonable outcome.
In an Australian first, Telstra recently showed a hologram to beam its chief technology officer live into Adelaide from Melbourne to talk to a major function.
So if you've got a product like that...
I'm going to talk about your favourite company and their warranty. In just a minute. So what's to say that I'm not who I say I am and I get on board?
Bit of common sense, people, please.
I wonder what their mobile broadband offering's like.
Damn iTunes. Damn it to hell, I say.
When you switch on your GPS, you do not switch off your brain.
That's even worse if it's gone back to Sydney and it's got that sort of downtime.
Let me tell you, high-definition television and Blu-ray, there's no comparison.
Yeah, look over here, look over here. Don't look at Vista, look over here.
Exactly, we've bypassed Vista completely. Yeah. We've gone to the next operating system.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Very good evening, everybody. Welcome wherever you are around the country. I'm Andrew McCon. This is Tech Talk Radio. Sitting across the panel from me this evening are two very willing and able gentlemen. Dr. Graham is in. Evening, Dr. Graham.
Good evening, Andrew.
How's life in the spam world? Have you been inundated with all the rubbish that's floating around at the moment with your customers?
Certainly
and the
a lot of it about. Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge to keep the spam filters up to date, but
it is.
We're doing our best
with all the stuff that's coming in. It's unbelievable.
It really is.
People that have, you know, things that you reckon you've subscribed to, but just. You know, you don't. Like, some CNN report came in today. I've never subscribed to it.
That's the big one at the moment, it seems, is the fake news items that get emailed around the place.
Well, that's the hook, isn't it?
Yep.
They can bait you and you click it, you're gone.
Some quite incredible headlines that these spammers seem to dream up.
Yep. Good evening, Justin. JD's here.
Good evening.
How's life in the Mac world over there? You've got your Dell tonight.
I know.
What happened?
The work machine tonight.
Oh, my goodness. Something you're not telling us? Or is it?
No.
Our Mac guru over here, he's brought the Dell in. Anyway, so yes, welcome aboard. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au is our email address if you'd like to contribute to tonight's show. Also, come up on our chat forum, chat.techtalkradio.com.au. Good evening to everyone who's logged in there as we speak. Now, the spam issue is becoming a real problem at the moment, especially for those who are, I guess, not so tech-savvy. Computer viruses have managed to hit 1 million too. The number of viruses, worms and Trojans in circulation has topped the 1 million mark. A new high for malicious programs was revealed by the security firm Symantec in the last edition of its biannual Internet Security Threat Report. And the vast majority of these programs have been created in the past 12 months. Does that surprise you, Graham? 12 months, they're all... Because it changes quickly, doesn't it?
It doesn't surprise me that these sort of statistics crop up in a Symantec scare you into buying our product report, no.
Oh, you're wearing that hat again tonight, are you?
The world's a very scary place.
It is.
Pay us money. Yeah.
That's right.
Hey, I bought the... I renegotiated and resubscribed to my Kaspersky subscription the other day too.
Oh, yes.
That's he's changed it from 2008 because, you know, we've had Eugene Kaspersky on the show here.
Yeah.
He's a very interesting Russian chap.
and he's changed his interfaces and GUIs a little bit, much to my liking, actually. It's probably one of the only open and honest device or programs that actually tells you what it's doing, not like some of the others that just sort of say, I've prevented this and you don't need to know.
Yeah, I must say, I've had a bit of a play with the trial versions of that that product and been impressed. It does find stuff that the other ones miss, that's for sure.
So does the GUI reflect Vista now? Is that the change? Or
no, I wouldn't say that. It's probably more user-friendly. It gives you more information on the screen as to what it's doing and how it's doing it, and it learns, obviously, what it used to do. It used to look at your emails and, you know, have a white list and a black list and all those things in between. And the more you use it, the more you get emails sent to you, the more thorough it becomes.
Right, so it just tells you what it's doing it's doing it.
Yeah, it does. It'll put little pop-ups on the screen, which you can turn off if it annoys you, but you can say, oh, look, you've opened up Excel and it's trying to talk to the internet. Is this okay? And you go, yeah. And it then remembers all that. So it's a bit of a self-education.
Why is Excel trying to talk to the internet?
You do, and it's funny because you get some really bizarre things like that come along. You go, what's that application? Oh, bloody iTunes again, you know, looking for another update. Well, you can see Safari again.
Yeah, well, you can see why iTunes might be talking to the internet, because it works that way. But yeah, that's the thing to watch out for with programs like that, is to think about when you click on the accept button, whether that program really should be talking to the internet, because if it's not, that might be an indication that something's wrong.
Mm. And the other thing too, cyber criminals have been pumping out malware to fool antivirus programs, which look for their characteristics. So they're trying to trick the tricksters now.
Yeah, well, that race has been going on for a while too.
Another one of the other big warnings out this week, Adobe. And we're not trying to put people off. We're just letting you know what's happening out there in the wide world of technology. Adobe, they make Flash, which is a fairly ubiquitous program, things. Which is on plenty of websites.
Yeah.
Now, Adobe's warning that its Flash video player is being used to push malware. The company said in a bulletin posting that malware writers have been using fake news video programs. Here we go again. That purport to offer video clips.
There you go.
So, once again, the Olympics. People will be putting video clips up and it'll be Flash players. I use Flash.
So, do you go to the Adobe website to make sure your Flash player is up to date? Is that the fix?
Don't know whether it's a Flash player thing or whether it's being embedded in videos and things like that, or they take you to sites. But Adobe said that the malware is being propagated through social networking sites in the way of spam comments advertising fake news stories.
And if you're using Google Street View, you need Flash 9. So every time you play with that, you're running Flash.
Okay, yep. And the Flash video they're talking about is the technology that makes YouTube work and all those other, you know, online video providers work.
It's a nice lean and mean way of getting, you know, video to your player. I must admit, with doing the cooking show that I do, all of our recipes get put up on the web server. So
I've noticed that.
Yes, good. Have you cooked any yet?
No, I haven't.
Hang on,
no.
wrong show. Technology.
The Banoffee pie is.
Must get him on the show.
It's probably gone by now, is it?
No, it might still be there. We'll get him on the show. He's a lovely chef, lovely bloke. He can talk technology and cooking.
That'd
excellent. Be interesting,
that would be
it?
Interesting, yeah.
Yes, Flash video. Where were we? yes, they're using Flash video, obviously, to, you know, hook people and viewers into going to those unscrupulous websites to pop-up thing. The attack is a later spin in the popular fake codec social engineering tactic.
Ah.
What's that? What's a fake codec? A codec that you have when you're
well,
not having a...
That's right. A codec is, it's short for coder decoder, which is a little bit of software that either encodes or decodes something like video or audio or something along those lines. So you have a codec that knows how to play MP3 files, for example.
Yes.
You have a codec that knows how to play often, or there's various other ones as well.
Okay.
You have a codec that knows how to play MP4 files, for example. One of the tricks that the bad guys use is they send you a video which says it needs a particular codec, but the codec that your player then goes off and tries to get doesn't decode the video, but in fact does something evil to your machine and takes over. Install something on your machine that you don't want.
Become a zombie.
Yeah, which is not what you want.
But it's in a lot of respects, it's good now that the only way you can actually get a lot of these things on your computer is by clicking, which I think in itself means that you've only got yourself to blame in a lot of respects. If your virus or any virus doesn't block it coming in via email, because all the spam these days have basically come to one line. You know, they'll use some stupid hook like Iran starts World War III,
yeah,
and they just put a link. hyperlink in an email.
That's exactly right.
Don't click it, but that's what they're doing. And that's seeming to get through all the spam filters.
Yeah, and that's because it's easier to use social engineering. In other words, it's easier to convince a human to do something against their own interest than it is to defeat the technological barriers. But there are still ones about that use technological means as well. So it's important to keep your machines up to date, do your Windows updates, all that sort of stuff. But if you've done all that and you still click on the link, then you might still get infected. So you just got to be careful with that.
Absolutely, especially if they're one step ahead of the protecting people software.
That's right, yeah.
Now, speaking of computer-based protection, CAPTCHA, which I think you came up with what that acronym stands for. Basically proves that you're human, and all that sort of stuff. It's, you know, those funny little numbers you type in onto your, you know, submit a message. Here's some characters, type those in.
Or how many cats are there on the letters?
There's
some weird ones like
really?
That.
Really? I haven't seen that one. I must admit, I am struggling with some of the CAPTCHA characters these days. Have two or three goes at it. Is it because I'm getting old or what?
Completely automated public Turing test to tell computers and humans apart.
Oh, you're a wealth of information there, Dr. Graham.
A Turing test being a well-known test for, you have a conversation and you try to determine whether it's with a person or with a computer.
Okay. Well, good. The reason why I'm talking about CAPTCHA is that poor old Google uses it to send emails, or if you're a Gmail user, well, that's been got. The spammers have finally got through that, so now we're starting to see spam arising from the Gmail
account. Yeah. There's been a couple of breaches of that particular CAPTCHA in the last couple of months. We reported on one a couple of months ago.
Also, the Olympics obviously being the real kick behind the generation of spam, because everyone likes to know what Olympics medals tallies are and things like that.
Yeah,
you hear all these funny stories that are coming out of it. That's really the hook that's got these guys going. But it's interesting to note that a spam has reached around about 150 billion messages a day. Imagine how fast the internet would go in this country if we didn't have that amount of spam going through it.
Yeah, it's a fair proportion of the traffic on the networks, that's for sure. It's definitely loading things up.
This is recently a survey found that in, I think, April or May, we got to that amazing amount, 150 billion spam messages on that one particular day. That's huge. That was on the 27th of March this year.
And you wonder why it takes 20 minutes to get an email out of Big Pond.
Well, yeah, that's a good point, actually. Because we run our own mail servers, and ours work really well because we don't have the volume or the traffic.
Well, I've noticed on Big Pond, because I'm a Big Pond user, it's actually their web interface that takes forever to clear email.
Oh, here we go. Really?
But using POP3 and IMAP is fine.
Yeah, they have their moments with their SMTP mail delivery, though. Sometimes a mail goes in and takes 20 minutes to come out again the other side of all the filtering.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed a difference between the web version and using an email client.
Yeah, the web, it probably goes through a different filtering process.
Mm. Mm. It took 20, 30 minutes easily from the web.
There's a valid discussion going on in the chat room at the moment.
Is there, Howard?
CAPTCHA is a nightmare when you're colorblind. And also CAPTCHA is a nightmare. I read that bit. CAPTCHA is a nightmare when you're colorblind. Yeah, I could imagine that.
Yeah.
Sorry, the screen scroll.
There's lots of issues for that with not just colorblindness, but other visual impairments. A lot of them have an audible CAPTCHA as well, where you can get it to play a sound that and you type in the words you hear as an alternative to the visual one. But it's a bit of a problem to make it secure and accessible. It's
one of our listeners,
a computer can't read it.
Well, yeah, that's the trick to it, isn't it? One of our listeners says he's had over 24,000 emails into his spam box over the last 30 days. Well, I'd be changing my email address if I were you. Because I think that's another thing you have to bear in mind these days too, that an email address is not permanent. You've got to change it every 12 months or 24 months.
It depends on the situation. But yes, once they get on the lists, they stay on the lists,
And I thought feedback at Tech Talk Radio was pretty savage with our spam, but boy, 24,000, that's a huge amount.
Mm.
All right. Now, moving right along, we had some correspondence in this week. For those of you listening to us, just a bit more about what's happening on the show tonight. Dr. Ron has been in the TARDIS. He's currently in Northern Ireland, and allegedly, I have spoken to him this evening, if mobile phone connections work for him in the northern part of Ireland, and I said, well, you know, you got half a chance, you're not in Australia, he will be calling in later on in this evening, which would be really good. Whilst we're in the UK, Brian sent us an email from Yorkshire in the UK just to confirm your query about the BBC on the last Tech Talk Radio podcast. Remember, we were talking about television licenses and
yes,
things
yes.
like that, how we should have them here in Australia to fund production locally and the likes.
Yes.
Just to confirm your query, he said, yes, we still pay for license fees to the BBC. It's currently, sitting down, £139. £139.
That's pounds?
Yes, per year. So do the maths on that. What are we at the moment?
That's just shy of $300.
Absolutely. Now, if everyone paid $300 towards television in Australia, boy, we'd have Auntie would be head and shoulders, wouldn't they?
There wouldn't be any competition left.
No, I think that's bring back pay TV. Literally.
Well, look at how good the ABC is currently doing things, particularly with online content.
Oh, iView's brilliant.
It is. Imagine the sort of production they could do if they had that sort of funding.
Oh yes, would be very very good. They've got 8 interactive TV channels, 10 radio networks, and more than 50 local TV and radio services. The BBC's website, bbc.co.uk, and the on-demand TV and radio services. BBC and iPlayer. Now, iPlayer is like what iView is here in Australia.
Yes.
It
may have been the same technology underneath.
Oh, it's not actually.
It's
completely different because I've actually been into iPlayer and I've downloaded the client. I came in through a proxy server to say, I'm in London. And I said, okay, here you go. So I got my little iPlayer from the BBC and I loaded it up. And no, it's nothing like what we've got here.
Oh, interesting.
I just think iView's better just quietly. Well done, ABC. So.
Well, the ABC have a history of doing these things well.
Yes, imagine if Telstra was still 100% government-owned. Where would we be today? The mind boggles, really. And it was about that point that the toner cartridge and the printer ran out. So I'm sorry, Brian, there is a bit more here, but it's a bit faded. Technology failed me in that instant. We did have another one here too, which I've currently misplaced at the moment, but nonetheless, it'll probably front itself very shortly. Oh, here we go. I knew I had it here. Simon, he sent us an email saying, interesting to note that there was a sharp increase in spam that coincided with the opening of the Olympic Games and has continued right through the weekend. The Gmail servers let many slip through for about 48 hours, but have since they've put their finger in the dike and captured it all.
Mm.
I think that's what they were saying on the chat room before too, that it sort of slowed down a little bit.
Yep.
Let's talk about Google's Street View. Have you been there? Have you checked out your house?
I have.
Have you seen any strange people climbing in through your window?
Not climbing in through my window,
seen
no.
Any Telstra vans outside of well-known brothels in certain parts of Australia?
There's a few.
The Google
funny.
Van has.
Yes.
There's some very funny pictures on some certain, I think the Age website in particular had some very interesting photos and stuff like that there. But as we went to air last week, Justin was saying, no, it's not there yet.
I was having a nice look at the roof of the studio, but we couldn't see the front of the studio last week.
And
now we can.
As soon as we went off air, they turned it on. Mm. They must have been listening to us.
Yep.
But Google Street View images are supposed to be taken in public roads, but they've done some fairly sneaky little turns. They've driven through one of the colleges just up the road from the studio.
Drove through Wesley, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. We drove through Wesley and a few things. They've been up, once again, you go to the Age website, which is a newspaper here in Melbourne, and you can see some great photos of where they've driven up private road, no trespassing and things like that. They've also
caught some people doing some things that, perhaps they shouldn't have been doing.
Oh, I haven't seen those photos. Really?
Yeah.
Just the people sleeping in cars on the job and stuff like that.
That sort of stuff. Yeah. And a bloke getting changed behind his car at the beach.
Oh, I saw that one. Yeah, that was very funny. Even the Google man himself, I think he was cleaning the lens and it took a snap of him. I think I saw that picture as well.
And my favourite one is the Google van driving through the McDonald's drive-thru.
Oh, yes. So if you've got some good Google photos, send them to us because I'm sure there'll be plenty of them out there. They haven't done some parts of town, which I'd expected them they would because we're based here in Melbourne. There's one of the salubrious areas, which this radio station we're going to air live on at the moment services, which is Boroondara. Half of Boroondara was not taken.
Ah, why is that?
Which is a fairly sizable slab of the affluent part of the eastern suburbs of Melbourne. There's also a few suburbs further south. Maybe he had a sickie that day. I don't know. Maybe the pictures. Maybe you forgot to put the film in the camera or something. I don't know.
Could be something like that.
But go and check yourself out and see if you can find your car parked out the front or, more importantly, somebody else's car. And go and quiz your partner. Whose car's that? It happened during summer, too. I've noticed predominantly around November, I think they did a lot of their stuff, November, December, January of this month. So
you figure that out from looking at clues in the pictures?
No, that's in the press release.
Oh.
But they did a bit of a swing around that in that particular point in time. So, and they're heading off to other countries too.
Oh, yeah.
As I alluded to in the opener.
Who gets it next?
The Kiwis. Watch out, Kiwis.
Oh.
I think there's some Kiwi stuff there already. But
lots of streets with sheep.
Yes.
Well, that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Hmm.
Hey, because we go on a bit, we're really running out of time already, and we haven't even started. We've got some very interesting stuff coming up on the show tonight. As I said, Dr. Ron may be calling in at 9:30. Simon Pierce is here from Symbian, and we're going to be talking about Windows Server 2008 rollout, how a large-scale organization has actually embraced the new technology and used it. Because we all go to these shows, and we see these great whiz-bang things that Microsoft present to us. Now we can hear exactly how it's worked.
In the real world.
And what hasn't worked, which is going to be good because everyone's sitting on the fence waiting for November to come around when Small Business Server 2008 gets the big tick and released to the masses. I'm quite looking forward to that. I'm going to put mine on the server and play with it and see how it works. In the meanwhile, Scrain, this is really a question for you. There's a lot of publicity around at the moment about this new DNS issue, which is seeming to be either, you can tell me this, are they beating this up or is this really as serious as some of these people are portraying it to be?
Well, it's potentially very serious.
Should we start from the beginning? DNS, the domain name service?
Is the service that turns a domain name like techtalkradio.com.au into an IP address.
Pretty harmless when
because
you think about it.
The IP address is how the network actually finds its way around, how a message gets from one place to another. It needs to go by IP address. But it's difficult for us to remember strings of numbers, so we use the domain names instead. And the DNS swaps one into the other. Now, this brings up the problem. If the DNS can be compromised, then what you can do is you can type in a real domain name, like techtalkradio.com.au, but not go to the right destination IP address. You go to the bad guy's IP address instead, and you might get something that looks like Tech Talk Radio, but isn't.
So you're going to nationalaustralia.com.
In the case of Tech Talk Radio, it's not so bad because you'll just get dodgy news, but as opposed to our legitimate news.
What do you mean?
In the case of, as you say, National Australia Bank or any of the banks or anything where you type in your username and password, if you go to a different site than you think you're going to, then you're potentially in a whole lot of trouble.
Yes.
So,
I'm just concerned the amount of media that it's getting at the moment. They're beating it up quite amazingly, and that's concerning me
It's because people who understand how reliant we are on the DNS for web services, but for it, not only for web services, but also for email and everything else that travels over the internet basically uses the DNS in some way or other. Okay, and if it can be compromised, it's really bad. And it means you can compromise all the other security measures if you can compromise the DNS. For example, because the DNS is also used to work out where to send emails, it's very easy for the bad guy to redirect the Commonwealth Bank's emails back to them instead of the Commonwealth Bank. So they could, for example, apply for an SSL certificate and get a security certificate for their dodgy site that looks like it's for the real site.
Oh, goodness.
So that's why, the compromising of the DNS allows them to compromise everything else.
There's nothing that the end consumer can do apart from using their intuition and common sense, really, to validate a site then, if that's the case.
If the compromises start affecting those other security measures, then yes, that's right. Mm. It would be impossible for the end user to tell. So that's why it's important that ISPs in particular update their DNS software so it's not vulnerable to these attacks.
Can I give you an example of how I do my DNS hacking at work?
Yeah, go on.
I think Simon might appreciate this, but inside in networks, you find that a lot of people behind your side of the firewall like chewing up your bandwidth by going to iTunes and going to not so much Facebook. What's the one? YouTube. And watching videos all day at work.
Yes.
So the way you block that is you actually get into your DNS server at work and you just route YouTube.com to nothing.
Yes. Or to localhost. So
and then you sit down there and you wait for everyone to come up and say, why can't I access YouTube?
Yep, that's right.
And it's a really good way of stopping everyone inside chewing through tons and tons of bandwidth. Because if you've got everyone sitting there watching YouTube, by goodness me, you can go through some bandwidth.
Yeah, and imagine if you're a bad guy and you redirected one of those websites that you didn't want your people going to another one that looked just like it, and you collected all the usernames and passwords.
I guess, and then that leads on to the point where you've got obviously a local DNS server within an organisation, which is what I've been tweaking with.
Yep.
But what about the DNS server of a major ISP or a telco?
Well, this is the point. The vulnerability is a poisoning vulnerability, which means you're injecting bad information into a DNS. So by being tricky, what somebody could do, they could take, say, a big ISP and target their DNS servers inject false information into the DNS server for the ISP, and then all the clients of that ISP, all of them, will be affected by that bad information. That bad information will get sent to all the clients of that of that provider.
So I guess for the average user who has no idea what we're talking about, is just use a bit of common sense when you're going to. Make sure it looks right, make sure it smells right.
And perhaps even ask your ISP if they've updated their DNS to be not vulnerable to these attacks.
Okay, Apple, JD, this is one for you, finally patched their dangerous floor DNS. Apparently there's been a bit of a fracas about this because it's been left unpatched for a while. Do you know anything about this? Apple has at last patched the DNS floor considered for one of the most dangerous vulnerabilities to affect the internet. On Friday, Apple posted a security advisory saying that the patch has fixed Apple's implementation of the Berkeley Internet Domain Name, or BIND. Is that what it stands for?
Yeah, the buggy internet domain service.
In Mac OS X, 10.4.1.1, 10.4, and all the rest of the other bits, up to 10.5.4. How come it took them so long?
Well, for the same reason. It doesn't matter so much on the client machines. It's the servers that needed the update, and they patched those separately. I don't know whether the server patch was done previously. I suspect it was, and this was the update to the client end.
Okay, good. Now, while we're talking about Mr. Jobs, He admitted MobileMe launch, which is their cloud, was a bit of a boo-boo to do that at the same time that they launched the iPhone. Steve Jobs has made an unprecedented move by admitting that Apple made a big mistake rolling out its paid-for cloud computing services, MobileMe, in one go. Are you subscribed to MobileMe? Says he, looking through the microphone.
No, I haven't. I think we actually told him it was a bad idea on the Monday after the launch.
Perhaps he's been listening.
Yeah, who knows? But I've heard there's been a lot of people not being able to access their emails and stuff like that. Is that basically where it's got to?
I'm not a subscriber, but as I understand it, MobileMe's been up and down a bit because of demand and software patching and various other problems. And as Mr. Jobs' email said, it was probably not such a good idea to release the update to the iPhone software for the previous version, the brand new iPhone, MobileMe, and iTunes App Store all on the same time.
It was fairly big of him to come out and say, oops.
Well, yes.
I don't think the other party would have done that.
Probably not.
No.
But, I think at least if you acknowledge the problem, you can move forward.
Absolutely. But credit to him, iTunes is still the number one music retailer. Have you bought off iTunes? I know you wouldn't have, says he, pointing at Graham, because I know you hate compressed music with a passion.
Yes.
But a lot of people don't mind it. They like that watery sound. As a result, Apple's iTunes Store has retained its position as the leading music retailer in the US, according to market research firm NPD. The company's latest results covered the first half of 2008. So they're obviously doing fairly well. They're very well entrenched here in Australia. I used a music site the other day to buy some music, but unfortunately came via Australia Post. So guess what I got? CDs.
Got a CD?
Ah,
much better than going to the shop, especially with the price of petrol these days. It costs you $10 just to drive the car out of the driveway.
Mm. Let alone parking around and around and around.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. And if you park in some of the areas that we live in, and just pulling over can cost you $55 if you're not careful. other interesting stuff that's happened this week as well, Network 10 is now driving content online. Network 10 has embarked on a digital projection to make its on-air content available online. Oh, they're following in the footsteps of the ABC.
Yes.
The project is expected to reduce the time taken to convert on-air content to online from a few hours to as close as real-time as possible. I wonder if they're going to start streaming. Not that there's anything on Channel 10 worth watching. That's my opinion.
That might be a matter of opinion, but yeah, no, it's interesting. It's good that they're being driven to try and improve this area. I think the ABC is setting a very high standard, and I don't know whether driving is the right term or whether they're following, but yeah, whatever they're doing, yeah, as long as the online services improve, they're going in the right direction, I think.
It's funny, like we run broadcast equipment where in the office where we are, and it's very easy to actually churn stuff. I can get stuff up online before it even goes to air. That's not bad, is it? So, and those people who watch our website quite often see it before it goes to air.
There you go.
Very sneaky of us. But that's what we do. Okay, so
well, how does the network feel about that?
Well, I haven't said anything. Not yet, anyway.
Fair enough. So, all right, moving on.
The other interesting bit of news this week, IBM and their friends promise a Microsoft-free desktop for a worldwide market. Now, I thought this was quite interesting.
Is OS 2 coming back?
OS 2, maybe. It's called Linux, actually. IBM, three major Linux distributors and their hardware partners are teaming up to deliver Microsoft-free desktop PCs to the 1 billion unit worldwide market. The cost could be as little as half of that of a Microsoft equivalent.
Mm.
But the days, this, I'm looking at this as Linux or anything, I'm saying the days are really numbered for Microsoft if they don't.
Sun is also pushing OpenOffice.org fairly hard.
They're giving that away.
That's entirely free.
And they're
promoting it on. They're promoting it when you download the Java client. So whenever your Java client updates, you get a big ad for OpenOffice.org, which is interesting. So
isn't that foistware as you used
no,
to call
No, because they're not installing it. They're telling you it's there and advertising it. So
pop-ups.
But it's just an ad advertisement that appears on the installer. But yeah, no, IBM have been interested in open source and Linux for quite a while, and they've had support on their, for example, on their X series servers, which is their Intel based servers and so on, for quite a while, for some of the open source operating systems, and it's obviously an extension of that they're
and they've got an interest in Unix. They've got their ARX operating system they had for their RISC based system some time ago.
Oh, so. They do, and that's still going. But yeah, they're also interested in Linux as well. So it's an interesting move. Obviously, they think that there's a lot of their clients out there are interested in it. So.
And I think we were talking before the show, and we'll talk again shortly. But the other issue is with someone like IBM providing support for Linux. Commercially,
that's right.
It's enormous,
and that's one of the big things with Linux is getting the support. But that's
Simon
that's an
will
issue
be in
we'll
a very
talk
good,
about.
Yes, we'll talk about that after our break when he joins us. Okay, the other interesting thing too this week, Mozilla, who are the people that bring us Firefox and all the open source goodies that we've been speaking of, or they're one of the providers, has released a prototype of a new application that aims to consolidate all their messages a user can receive over a computer into one reader package.
Oh, yes.
Is this new or what? Like, I would have thought most email clients could do something like this. Why is Mozilla any different? Dubbed Snowl, that's spelt S-N-O-W-L, the application intends to treat all messages as the same and lets the user get emails, RSS feeds, instant messaging, and even, heaven help them, Twitter messages and alerts from social networking sites in one reader.
So it's not just email, it's all the other things as well.
You can plug your Twitter in, you can plug in your...
We had a bit of a play with some web-based versions of this a few shows back when we first started talking about Twitter.
Yeah, that tried to link all your various updates, all your status messages on Facebook and Twitter and all of those together. Yeah, so this is a kind of an extension of
but
that,
But this
I
is
suppose.
A client you can use.
Hmm. Interesting idea.
It is indeed.
There's certainly an issue, as we've found in here, with, we've got chat rooms, we've got forums, we've got SMS, we've got email.
Trying to get rid of those. Come back to the chat room. It's all easy that way.
Trying to keep up with all the different technologies, the different ways you can interact with people online is a huge challenge. So, it's obviously something that software developers are working on.
All right. It's time to take a break because we've been going for a while. When we return, we're going to be talking with Simon Pierce from Symbian. We've also got Adam Turner, who's our regular writer for the Age Green Guide, the Sydney Morning Herald. He's going to be talking to us about the Chumbie. Do you know what a Chumbie is?
Not a clue.
Good. Well, you'll have to stick around and find out. That's after the break.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
If you listen to Tech Talk Radio live, you've probably wondered why you can't chat with the panellists in real time. Surely such technology exists. Well, now it does. chat.techtalkradio.com.au. By popular demand, you can now chat real time with panellists and other Tech Talk enthusiasts. All you need is a web browser, an internet connection, and a comfy chair. Monday nights at 8 p.m, go to chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
So, what's a Chumbie? Worked out what a Chumbie is yet?
No.
The guys in the forum are speculating about it at the moment. Chumbie, it's a little box that sits on your bedside table, or anywhere for that matter. Adam Turner is the proud owner of one of these said devices. In fact, I wouldn't surprise me if he's listening to us on it right now, probably, but he's moving house, so he may not be. If he's got any broadband and he's got any telephony at all after what happened last week, and I haven't sent him any emails for a while, so that might still work, so... Anyway, Adam's view from a couch this week is all about the Chumbie, which on the surface I think sounds like a relatively nice little box. I wouldn't mind getting one. But anyway, each to everyone's thing, and have a listen and see what you think. But the Chumbie, wonder if it could be one of Tech Talk Radio's gadgets of the week coming up. But here's what Adam thinks. The Chumbie.
MTV's Pimp My Ride features a team of revheads converting a viewer's stock standard car into a customised beast on wheels. But if you gave these guys a boring old clock radio, you'd get back something like the Chumbie. The Chumbie is basically a tiny internet-enabled widget player. It's roughly the size of a tub of margarine tipped on its side. The Chumbie features a 3.5-inch LCD touchscreen embedded in a plush beanbag-like casing. There's also a Wi-Fi adapter for connecting to your wireless network. You can program it via the Chumbie website, configuring it to run a range of applications such as photo slideshows, internet radio stations, podcasts, news and weather reports, games and RSS feeds. It runs on Linux and it's specifically designed to be customized, so an online community has grown up around Chumbie modding. Chumbies cost $180 US, but unfortunately Chumbie's makers only deliver within the US, so the widgets are very US centric. Obtaining a Chumbie outside the US involves having a friend in the US order one for you and then post it to you. This sounds like a hassle, but of course the same restrictions applied to the first generation iPhone, and that didn't seem to stop around 50,000 of the suckers flooding into Australia. Anyway, along with playing widgets, the Chumbie is also a highly flexible alarm clock that lets you create multiple alarms for different days of the week and customise the snooze time. You can set it to wake you up with a beep or else music from an internet radio station or an MP3 from an attached USB stick. Alarms can also be used to trigger different widgets at different times of day. Like many new technologies, the Chumbie is a solution looking for the right problem. The two most practical applications for a Chumbie are as a bedside alarm clock or a desktop photo frame. Other uses are limited by the small screen and the fact that it needs to stay plugged into the wall, although some Chumbies have been modified to run on batteries. The Chumbie would seem to be the nerd's ultimate alarm clock. After waking you up, it can scroll the day's news and weather, along with family photos and even the day's events from your Google Calendar. We found the Wi-Fi link to be a little flaky when it comes to internet radio, which quickly becomes annoying. Another frustration is the small on-screen buttons, which can be hard to press, especially when you're stabbing at the snooze button at the crack of dawn. The latest firmware upgrade for the Chumbie increased the size of the alarm buttons, but there's still a lot of work to be done here on the interface. Unfortunately, the Chumbie's rather bright to have by the bed, even in night mode when the screen is set to black and the time is displayed in grey. This is the nature of LCD, because it has a constant backlight. Surprisingly, there's no way to completely disable the screen on the Chumbie, so our solution has been to face it away from the bed at night, which kind of defeats the purpose. The other problem is that when the Chumbie is displaying a widget, it's not displaying the time, so you still might want to retain your bedside clock. About now, you're wondering why you've spent $180 US on an alarm clock that's not much of a clock. Still, I really like the fact that it can tell me the weather in the morning, and it can tell me what I've got on today, and my kids love to sit on the bed and watch the photos scroll past where they call out the names of the people in them, so I reckon that I'm getting my value out of it. What the Chumbie really needs is a separate LED screen just for displaying the time. Then you could shut down the LCD screen at night. Of course, all of this would be less of an issue if you were using the Chumbie at work as the ultimate desktop bling, perhaps as an RSS reader or a YouTube viewer and a digital photo frame pulling down images from Flickr. Unfortunately, the Chumbie doesn't feature an Ethernet port. It only supports WEP WPA and WPA to PSK wireless networks. So you're out of luck if your workplace uses WPA or WPA2 enterprise wireless encryption, which a lot of workplaces would. You may find that you need to talk to the nerds in the IT department if you want to get a Chumbie working on your desk. All up, the Chumbie is an amazing device, but as toys go, it's not cheap. Ultimately, your opinion of it will depend on whether or not you find a good use for it.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And someone's asked on the forum, does the Chumbi multitask? That's a very good question. Maybe, maybe not. You'll have to buy one and find out. Adam might pop up later and he'll be able to tell us all about those sort of things. So anyway, there's the Chumbi, a lovely little $180 US dollar box you can have sitting on your bedside table if you choose to, or in your office or in a kitchen or wherever else it might want to go. Windows Server 2008 is a very interesting new bit of technology which Microsoft has put onto the market. It's currently available in its standalone form of Server 2008, and it's reasonably priced for those small enterprises that want to go down the path of getting online from in their office, running a small collaborative environment where you can share all those sort of good things. Coming up very shortly in November, we're going to see the launch of Server 2003 Small Business Server.
Mm.
Now, that's going to be interesting with all their new virtual machine ware and all that sort of stuff which is coming out.
Yeah, I've got several clients using Small Business Server 2003, and so we're looking forward to seeing what Small Business Server 2008 looks like.
Have you seen a beta version, or have you got a build of it yet that you've plugged in
haven't,
and turned on?
Haven't built one yet, no. No, I've read a few things about it. But
people are actually using 2008 as a server as a workstation because,
yeah, I've heard this.
Because it's better than Vista, apparently. Oh, who said that?
Mm.
Anyway, let's introduce to the panel this evening, our guest this evening, Simon Pierce from Symbian. Good evening, Simon. Thank you for traversing all the ways through Melbourne's rotten weather to join us this evening.
Good evening. Thanks very much for having me on.
Hey, no worries. Now, tell me a little bit about Symbian and what you do and how Server 2008 helps what you do.
Symbian Health, the part I work in is Symbian Pharmacy Services. We have an application called MinFOS. The MinFOS application is for pharmacies across Australia for brands such as Terry White, Ken Martin, Pharmacy Choice. The application itself is a point of sale, dispensary, warehouse, multi-site and accounting package all in one. So it's a comprehensive end-to-end package that all our brands use.
So do they connect in somehow to you via how? How do they talk to you?
Okay, so basically we have a process that runs every night, collecting the sales information, ordering information from each pharmacy, which is pulled back into the Symbian head office, and we chop the data up. And
okay, so if they run out of tablet A or tablet B or prescription, I don't know, whatever they run out of, they don't even have to contact you. It sort of automatically comes up and you ship them what you think they want.
That's
is that right?
We have predictive ordering and we also look at their sales. So we compare each Terry White across Australia, Chemmart or Pharmacy Choice and say, show them how they're doing against each other stores and where they can improve, what areas are selling, what areas aren't selling. We also have automatic ordering. So they can set and forget ordering, dials into the Symbian head office, and
that's
the order
is there.
That's
got to be handy for chemists because that's the last thing you want to do.
Correct. So we can look over 12 months, look at seasonal ordering, ordering over a certain period of time, and predict what stock they're going to need.
All right. Now, you've just migrated, I think you said about November last year, from what to Server 2008?
The MinFOS system itself is actually a legacy Novell application, so it actually runs a custom database on a Novell platform. Therein lies the problem. With Novell calling the end of life on the product, we've had to look at our options and what we can do in the future.
So you were forced to change, really?
Pretty much.
And you chose Server 2008. Why?
Number of reasons. Number one, support for the other systems in the market.
That'd be pretty important, I think, in today's modern business world, getting someone on the end of the phone when you need, sort of like, hey, what's going on here?
That's correct. We have pharmacies across Australia. So we have pharmacies in Broome, Northern Territory, Western Australia, South Australia, Coober Pedy. To get a Linux technician on site, on some of those, it's near impossible. We have to fly them there. There's just no support available. So that was one of our key concerns.
For getting a Microsoft technician, I guess there's a few more of them around than a Linux one, but you would surely start off with a phone support. Is that even better than physical on-site support?
That's correct. We have ourselves in MinFOS, we all have a level 1 and a level 2 support. We'll do the basic application support, server support where we can. We then have hardware vendors that take care of the operating system on site as well as all the desktop support.
Okay, so your choice was based solely around the fact that you had to move away from obsolete or a non-supported platform into a new environment. That in itself, at the scale that you're sort of talking about, would have been fairly daunting.
Correct. So
how long planning? Like, what was this? Sit around and sort of like, oh, boys, is this going to be fun? Or how did it go?
We've been planning over 2.5 years now. So initially, we decided to rewrite the MinFOS application database into a Novell platform. Novell then pulled the pin on us and said, sorry, guys, we're not supporting that anymore. Back to the drawing board. What database?
Gee, that would have gone down well.
Went down very well with the Symbian management. So then again, we had to look at our options for database engines. that's when we chose to move to the Microsoft operating system and the Elevate DB, actually open source SQL engine.
Now, okay, talking a little bit about databases and things like that, do you house all your technology in your own environment, or do you outsource that to some hosting organizations, or how do you do that?
Each pharmacy has its own database server. So across 600 sites, there's 600 instances of database, and we also have our own in-house databases that pull the information back and analyze that information.
And now, do you do this across like a private network, or is it standard TCP IP over the
it's
internet?
It's across an IPsec VPN network.
Okay, so relatively secure, I guess. But a server in each chemist?
That's correct.
So that's a big... That's huge.
That's great. Yes.
What made you choose that?
Reliability is number one. We have pharmacists that operate 24/7. If their server's down, they can't trade. With the older technology, there was no database replication. There's nothing like that to sort of for failover. So that's when we started looking at what was available, what was one of the most solid platforms. We invited Novell to come along. We invited Microsoft. Microsoft actually stepped up to the plate and pleasantly surprised us with both support, showing us what their application can do, and then actually allowing us to participate in the RDP program.
Okay. So what Novell just didn't want to know about, is that really what happened, or they...
Pretty much. Yeah. Novell stepped up to the plate and came back to us with an inquiry about why we have so many licenses they can't find. So we weren't very impressed with their overall reaction.
Customer service is fairly important these day and age, whether you be a consumer who's got a dodgy iPhone or iPod or something, or a mobile phone, through to when you invest a lot of money in these sort of technologies. But you've rolled out a Windows 2008 server in each particular chemist, and they would then obviously use their cash register, I'm assuming, tell me if I'm wrong, they've hooked up their cash registers, their databases for their customers on there and things like that when they do subscriptions.
Basically, what we have, we've got EFT tools, so they're computer tools. Actually a Toshiba product we're using across Australia. So it's a fully integrated tool module with Windows XP Professional built into it. It actually hooks into the Minfos database, which houses all their customer information.
Interesting that you say XP.
Yes, we don't use Vista that much.
Well, see, that's the thing, isn't it? Because Microsoft have touted that 2003, Server 2003 and XP were, husband and wife. And as a result, when you move to 2008 Server, Vista is supposedly the partner of choice for Server 2008. Yet Service Pack 3, which came out recently for Windows XP, has put a lot of the good things that Vista has into... So you've obviously chosen that for a reason?
Generally, we recommend XP. It does run quicker than Vista. It takes all the nice little things that we just don't need in there, and it just runs our application straight out of the box.
And you guys sleep a bit better at night.
We certainly do. Absolutely.
I think in a lot of respects, that's why people are still actually choosing to go with the known tiger as the moment. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong company. the known beast out of the box, I guess, compared to the others. All right, let's go back to the planning process. You've chosen to move from one platform to another. That in itself, to me, would be incredibly daunting, especially when you have chemist livelihoods on the line. How did you go about it, and what sort of redundancy did you do? Did you run systems in parallel for a bit while you tested it out?
That's great.
How did it go?
We initially ran internal tests on the system. So the first thing was to build an actual Minfos database application that would run the custom database format. So that was the first thing we had to achieve. Once that was achieved, we had to ensure the system reliability and stability of the product. Again, we ran this trial over about 2 months, 2.5 months, and we found that the application ran fairly well, and in some cases ran better than the Novell product. Keep in mind, this application has been around 20 years, so it was originally developed when Novell was the dominant.
So you would have been fairly comfortable with that product. Yeah, so yes. This is really pushing you out of your comfort zone here,
certainly
wasn't it?
Certainly is, yep. Certainly was. From there, we actually moved to 3 in-store trials, one being a Greenfield site, so a complete new Minfos site running the 2008 server, the second being an upgrade from Windows 2003, and the third being an upgrade from Novell. Our first one was the upgrade from the 2003 server with Terry White Southland. That server went in over a period of about 3.5 hours, got the system up and running, and it actually ran flawlessly from day one. No crashes, no speed issues, nothing like that. So we're very...
That's got to be good result then. So you obviously all slept well going, oh, this is going to work.
I got a lot of sleep that weekend.
So did that mean whilst you were doing the development that you had to run the database in parallel on Novell and Windows?
That's correct. The technology we use actually creates something called a TTS file, which is a record of all the transactions that are created on that data on that database. So if anything went pear-shaped, we actually had the Novell server sitting next to it, and all we need to do is replay that TTS file to bring up to that point in time. So we had a recovery action plan.
How confident were your customers of the... Were they sceptical? Were they, you know, they said, oh, these guys do it right?
No, it was actually well embraced by our customers. A lot of them commented, why haven't you done this sooner? Which was to my surprise.
Well, okay, that's a pleasant response really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually even reflected in our sales. Our sales have actually increased a fair proportion over the last... from August last year since we've announced to all our customers. From the 600 customers Australia-wide, we've had over 35% already convert. With all the major grips in the pharmacy world have committed as well. So it's okay. A fairly...
Excellent. Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, what we might do is we might take a little bit of a break and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about this. I know that's a very bold step in a lot of organizations, not only just moving up a platform in server technology, moving from, say, 2003 to 2008 would be fairly daunting at the best of times, but you've gone completely from one end of the spectrum across to the other, which I think is... It's a fairly bold step. But anyway, it seems to be good. We'll talk a little bit more about it when we come back, just after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPod.
Betty's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking of the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on E-Pray, and you get a whole service. Just on.
How does it go?
It goes...
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Oh, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Yes, there was another show going on here in the studio. We've probably better talk. Andrew McComb here.
We often seem to do that.
It happens, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Graham Callaghan, Justin Dunlop is here. And our guest this evening is Simon Pierce from Symbian. And they've just done the big brave move of changing platforms for their business and moving from basically rebuilding this whole system from the ground up, as we've just discovered. Simon, how is it so far? Like, what's the reaction from everybody? Are they happy with it? Because you've had to basically start again, haven't you? It's like rebuilding a house.
So we've had to rebuild the application from start. So that means a database transformation as well as an application rebuild.
That in itself is a big job.
Yes, very big.
How many people you got doing this sort of stuff?
It's about 17 at the moment.
Ah, good. They're good friends, I hope. There'd be lots of late nights there, I reckon. Pizzas?
Late nights, pizzas, yeah, sometimes, if we're allowed.
So obviously they've been sitting there developing away. Now, what normally goes hand in hand with Microsoft products is their C++ platform .NET. What are you using to write all this stuff in?
We're actually using Ball and Rad Design Studio.
Oh, so you've moved away from the incumbents, their offering, and you've tried some. Is there a reason for that?
That was the choice of the development manager. Not sure of his reasons.
Was it a good choice?
So far, so good.
Okay, well, that's good.
So far, so good. Nothing's broken, so we're happy with that.
Has anything happened that you didn't expect? Have you had any sort of like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do here? Or has it all just been smooth sailing?
It's actually been smooth sailing. I mean, I think when I was talking to you before, the first time I did the Windows installation, I put the set in and it said, you know, come back in 20 minutes. I came back in 20 minutes and it worked. I went, you know, that can't be right. What's wrong? Sure enough, it actually worked. So
don't tell me the actual time it took to install it actually told you correctly.
That is correct.
That's unheard of in computer world, isn't it?
It's unheard of in Microsoft land anyway.
Rather surprising. And, you know, the thing that was the biggest surprise to me was, you know, from the NT4 days to the 2008, it just worked out of the box. There was no complex setups. The hardest thing we had to do was open a port in the firewall, and our application just ran and worked.
So that's impressive, isn't it?
I'll clarify that. 20 minutes from putting the disk into having server 2008 running on a box.
25 minutes.
That would have to be half the time, if not a third of the time, of a 2003 install.
Presumably this is running on some really huge 8-core, you know, 20 gig of RAM.
He's shaking his head. That's not good for radio.
HP ML310.
An ML310.
ML310.
And so that's a perfectly ordinary server like anybody might have in their, any small company might have in their back office.
That's correct.
Did you option it up with anything? Because for those of you who aren't familiar with 2008 server, it's modularized now. It comes with a server core, which is your basic, what you must haves. And then you can plug things into it, like web servers and the likes. Did you add anything to it?
No, basically we installed the core server and the MinFOS server application on top of the Windows 2008 server. So that's what we didn't have to install IIS. We didn't have to install all these other little fancy options that you don't really want and you have to then remove in 2003.
Ah.
So that's what cut down so much time in the installation.
And that'll help with the performance of the machine as well, not running all that extra stuff in background too.
Absolutely.
Mm.
And more importantly, what do your clients think of it? Have you had good reaction? I think we touched briefly on this before, but...
I've had no complaints, which says a lot in itself. In the past, if something goes wrong, I certainly know about it. And I have customers on the phone going, you know, I'm trying to run a business here, my server's down, my server's not working. I didn't hear
Well, that's not a nice phone call to get that.
No. I didn't hear from the beta site for 2 weeks and I went... Either What's it's wrong? Broken or he's gone on holiday. I'm not sure which one yet. So I went down for a visit and he was there smiling away saying, I like my new toys.
That's really promising, isn't it, for a new technology rollout? So, all right, let's talk a bit about the cost. Was it an expensive thing to roll out? Because you've gone from one to another and you've had to redevelop your software from the ground up. What about licensing and things like that? How did that
licensing has actually come down from the Novell product. Some of our pharmacies were paying up to $3,000 per year for the licensing rights.
That'd be pretty big for a small pharmacy.
That's huge. Some of the bigger pharmacies, $3,000 a year, that's just money they don't want to spend, and they won't if they don't have to. With the Microsoft product, Microsoft actually came to the party and said, hey, we'll offer you this deal for all your pharmacies, special one-off rate of $1,200, including 5 cows. So we're rather impressed with
a cow. That's a client access license. That means you can have 5 other terminals talking to your server.
That's correct.
Sorry, Graham, you going to say something?
No, I was going to say exactly that. That's all right.
So it's cheaper and it's faster and appears more reliable from what you were saying.
So far.
So far, so good. All right, well, that's really encouraging, I guess, to a small business who wants to do the migration from 2003 to 2008. So in just recapping what you've said, a lot of the applications that 2003 install, you don't need anymore. So hence the reason why your install time goes down to 20 minutes or something like that. That's fantastic. What about hardware relation? I know you've just touched on what you've installed it on. Is there any sort of warnings or anything like that you give to people or sort of say, oh, make sure you've got plenty of RAM or anything like that when they're installing 2008?
Yeah, we have minimum specification document on our website. So if for all our potential customers, they can actually go on and have a look through that document. So we generally look at a 3 gigahertz processor for our server.
Oh, that's pretty standard these days.
Around 2 gig of RAM and, you know, multiple hard disks.
Yeah. So do you have
Do you have
specifications around the brand or the type of video card to cut down on the compatibility problems?
No, we recommend HP products, so the HP ML series. Mm-hmm. We've had minimal issues with those, and as well as any Intel white boxes. We haven't had any problems with drivers, with the system loading or anything like that. It's just come up and worked.
You're installing it on the same hardware that the previous server uses out at the customer site, or are they buying new servers?
In some cases, no. It depends on the age of the equipment. If we have servers that are 5 years old and 7 years old, in some cases, we just say, guys, you know, it's time to upgrade. Time to put the hand in the pocket. You know, your Novell server that's been sitting there for 5 years or 7 years just, you know, it won't cut the mustard. So they've then upgraded their hardware. Some of them have done a complete swap over from the old Novell server that I bought 6 months ago to a brand new Novell server.
Right.
Windows server.
Windows server. Hmm. Interesting.
What's the weakest link?
Hopefully not our software.
No, it sounds like it won't be. It's probably more like a connectivity issue, which seems to be everything these days. Someone trips over an extension lead somewhere. Heaven help you if you're in Queensland and you're an Optus customer. You've got two chances of staying in business. Someone will dig a backhoe through it or something like that. But no, seriously.
I think the hardest thing we've had is getting all our customers to the Windows platform, because we have customers which are so diverse. We have some that are more than happy to spend what's required, some that aren't. It's really come down to talking to the people and saying, look, this is something you need to do to look at this new technology. And when we show them what the new application is capable of, they go, oh, wow, okay, we'll change next week.
But also the model of distribution you're using sounds like it's a synced software. So at the client side, so at the pharmacy, they're keeping all their data local and they've probably got it backed up on disk or tape or something locally, and it's batching it all up overnight to the central server. So if you lose your internet connection, okay, you may not get the product that day. You have to suffer some pitfalls from a failure. But the next day it will go up, or as soon as the internet connection's back, it will sync.
That's correct. We have both methods. So we have the automatic internet uploading, and we also have the old dial-up modem. So you can dial up your orders if there's something wrong with the internet and make sure that you get the deliveries.
A fallback to the old dial-up modem. Now, that's romantic, isn't it? So we have to listen to AM radio at the same time while you're doing that. You know? Simon, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you this evening. My last question, how do you rate Server 2008? Are we talking it's a good step forward or it's an amazing step forward? How would you sort of classify it in respect to your business model? Is it doing everything you want for you, or is it surprisingly better?
Probably the key word is surprisingly better. I didn't really have high expectations of the product when I first got it. I thought, here we go again.
Were a cynic when it first came out.
I was a very big cynic. I thought, okay, here's
this. That's why you got the roadshows, really,
isn't it? You're a cynic because of experiences with Server 2003? Or
more Vista product.
Okay. If it's based on Vista, then we're going to have trouble.
Then we'll go 2003. Thank you very much. And very happy with the product when it was released to us. And you know, we sat down with Microsoft and the guys from CAS. It completely changed me from a cynic going, you know, this is not going to work, to I'm actually pleasantly surprised and thought, okay, this is actually possible.
Well, that's good. Hopefully you'll encourage people to make the step into the world of 2008, because it is. It's a big decision for small business, even large businesses to a lot of extent. The relationship between XP, Vista, and the server technology seems to be not an issue. Would you say that?
Vista will probably be the pitfall. Again, I suppose going back to our legacy with Novell, when Vista was launched, it doesn't talk to Novell servers. So that was our first one of our biggest problems. So then we looked at, you know, moving to a 2003 server. Yes, it talked, because you can run TCP/IP between the two client and server applications.
Mm. All right. Well, thanks for giving us an insight on how the Symbian system works and how we get all our chemists talking to one another. I didn't know it was so intricate is probably the word. Simon, thank you very much for your time this evening. I've learned a lot and it's been encouraging for me. I'm quite excited now. I'm going to go load up my demo discs. I'm waiting for 2003 to come out and the server to come out. 2008 server to come out.
Small
and the
server,
Because that'll be
really looking forward to that one too.
Absolutely good to roll it all out. So, once again, Simon, many thanks for making the journey in this evening.
Thanks for
I've learned a lot. It's been great.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Yes. Welcome back. Tech Talk Radio, Andrew McComb. Graham Cullion is here in present.
Yes.
Virtual Dr. Ron is about to join us.
Really?
Really, truly. We've got technology working here in the studio this evening.
Wow.
It's amazing, isn't it? And, of course, we've got Justin down the end there, hiding behind his Dell computer this evening.
Don't rub it in.
Sorry. It was quite interesting hearing about all that interesting, you know, rollout of 2008, because it is. It's quite unnerving for some organisations, I would have thought, to go down that, make that decision.
Oh, no doubt it would be, yeah. But
how do you go selling it into some of your customers? Like, you say you really should upgrade from Windows 95 to Vista.
Well, we try to be sensible about it and recommend the right thing for the right customers. But yeah, it's very hard to recommend Vista, and we haven't.
Yeah, but I know, it's hard, isn't it? Very hard.
It's, I'm as I said before the break, Server 2008 Small Business Server is the one I'm hanging out for, because we've got a few Small Business Server 2003 clients, and that's served them fairly well. But if it's as big a step forward as Simon was suggesting, then it could be really good. The only thing that worries me though is that perhaps some of the advantages that he found with Server 2008 was in removing a lot of the extras, whereas in Small Business Server the whole point is that all the extras are there, that you are running Exchange and IIS and
it's pretty heavy, isn't it?
And all that sort of stuff, so it can get a bit heavy.
SharePoint, but that's interesting.
It should be no worse than 2003, and perhaps a little bit smoother and a little bit better.
Yeah, that'll be good. Oh, it's very regal, isn't it?
What have we got happening here?
I think Dr. Ron's about to enter the room. He's currently in Ireland. We spoke to him earlier this evening, and he's taken some time out. Very graciously, we are here at the Tech Talk panel to hear that he's having a cup of coffee, sitting up there somewhere. He's not quite in England. He was there yesterday. So it's wrong national anthem.
It's the wrong music. Yeah.
It was this on the Doctor Who theme, so I just happened to find this. Anyway, this is Australia calling Ireland. Come in, Dr. Ron, are you there?
Come in, base, over.
There he is. He's there. Dr. Ron, welcome to Tech Talk Radio. You remember us?
Thank you very much. Yes, I do remember you. As far as the music goes, well, I'm in the north of Ireland, so I suppose you get away with that a little bit more than you would if I was in the south, but that's okay anyhow.
So what are you doing? How's the holiday going? Have we caught you at a bad time? Or what's the weather like? 20 questions. Your turn now.
Do I ask the questions or do I give the answers? My first question is, what's up with JD and the Dell computer? I'll leave the country for a couple of weeks and the place turns to crap.
Don't worry. By the time you get back, it'll be gone.
Okay. Good to hear, JD. No, I'm actually, at the moment, I'm in Ballycastle, which is a small town up the northeast of Northern Ireland. So it's in... County. I'm looking at my map here. Hang on a minute.
This is Google Maps not working.
The joys of being a tourist. Yeah, what's going on with the Google Maps? Hey, we've got Street View here now. Have you seen?
County Antrim. We're in County Antrim. I have. I had a look at Street View the other day. It's incredibly fast, and all the addresses I punched in, they all came up very well with photographs of the addresses. So that's very good.
Did they blur your house for you as you asked?
Yes, and my number plate's been blurred as well on the Audi and the Volvo at the front too, so that's good.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Now, tell me, how have you found technology in your trip so far? Has it all worked for you? Obviously, you're using your Australian mobile phone provider over there quite well. How's it? How's the coverage? Better than expected? What's it like?
No, it's very good. The mobile phone's been working extremely well. I'm talking to you at the moment on my little iMate. And I've been using that for Wi-Fi as well as for mobile phone communications. And I'm roaming at the moment on O2 UK. That's the carrier that I'm roaming on. But in the major cities, like in Belfast last night, and also in the major cities in England, I've had 3 coverage. And they're pretty good. They just charge a 25-cent flag fall for making calls and for receiving calls. But otherwise, the rates are the same as they are in Oz. So technology-wise, everything's been going well.
What about public Wi-Fi? Have you been able to get the thing to connect onto any Wi-Fi networks over there?
Yeah, I have, Graham, heaps. And a really good example was in Manchester, where there's just free Wi-Fi everywhere. Australia's really got a lot to learn. You just essentially connect and off you go. So I had great Wi-Fi in Manchester. That was working really well. There was Wi-Fi available in the motel in Belfast last night, but you had to pay for it. I think it's about £1 per... 5 minutes or £2 for half an hour, something along those lines. So that's about $2 or $3 or $5 or something for half an hour. There's plenty of free Wi-Fi around, though, which is really good.
Warlock on the chat at the moment wants to know if you had a Guinness yet.
Hi, Warlock. I haven't. As some of you will know, I'm a keen Guinness drinker, and I know what it's like in town in Melbourne. But I'm saving my first Guinness over here to be at the Guinness factory in the heart of Dublin, which will be in a few days' time. So I'll let you know how it compares from the very the origins of where Guinness comes from, with what it's like on the other side of the world.
It'll be interesting to get a report through the bottom of the glass. It might be a bit murky, but it'll be through the bottom of the glass. So how has the rest of the technological journey been so far? Obviously, Wi-Fi is working for you. You're roaming really well. It just seems to work, obviously.
It does. TV's really good. Everyone's got dozens and dozens of TV channels here through BBC, and there's also ITV and other channels as well. The radio is terrific. Australia is just a technology backwater when it comes to digital stuff like television and radio. The driving around in the car, you can just hit the button for your traffic information. Every half hour, your program is just briefly interrupted by traffic announcements with any congestion information or breakdown information on the whatever motorway you're on. So it works extremely well here, the digital radio. And that's not DAB either. I think that's what they call RDS, which is the traffic information services. But there's also DAB available as well, which is the fully digital high-def audio radio.
All right, so the digital radio you're using is a digital add-on to the analog radio, whereas the DAB is the fully digital radio. But you haven't had a chance to play with that yet?
Yeah, have you got the digital in the car?
No, we don't have digital in the car. I think what Graeme said is correct, and it's like a digital add-on which gives you the extra traffic information. You can opt in or opt out for that, and that's all completely 100% free, of course. Haven't had to play around with the fully digital radio yet, though, but hopefully I'll be hiring a car that'll have that in it, and we'll put it through the hoops.
So what have you been up to over there? I know you've been visiting weddings and friends and stuff like that, but has everything else gone according to plan? Like, what's the price of petrol? I was curious to know in Ireland at the moment how the economic scale of things is going.
Yeah, it's about, at the moment, I'm driving a diesel car, which is it's a little Peugeot diesel, and it's going great guns. And the diesel's about, at the moment where we are here, I think I saw before in Ballycastle, it's about £1.30, which is probably about $2.60, $2.70 a litre in Australian language, but that's about the going price here. And you say to people that it's half that in Australia, and their jaw just hits the ground. They go, what, how come it's so cheap over there? But, of course, we're just always moaning and groaning about how expensive it is at home, aren't we?
Well, yeah, it's one of those things that everyone likes talking about and whinging and moaning. But anyway, yes, we do get it fairly well over here, I think. We'd have to sort of agree. All right, so what's on the plans next? What are you doing now?
Well, we're going for a trip around doing the touristy things over the next few days. We're going for a trip around the Causeway Coast this afternoon. So from Ballycastle, we're going along to the Giant's Causeway, which is a massive rock formation, amazing rock formation right on the coast. And then we'll be coming back down probably through Coleraine, maybe, back down in towards Belfast. We're staying in Belfast for a couple of nights. Then we're driving to Dublin. So probably the next time I'll speak to you will be from Dublin.
Oh, that'd be good. Have you got any internet access, or are you using it purely on the, have you experienced friends, families, email connections, internet connections over there, or are you using it purely on your little portable device?
A bit of both. I've been using the portable device when I've been travelling in the motels, but staying with friends and family, they've had internet available in their houses, and it's very, very fast here. I was very impressed with the speed, especially serving sites from Australia. It's been great. So they're all pretty much exclusively using DSL, but it's a very fast DSL. It's not what certainly not what we're accustomed to. It's like really fast, like cable broadband at home. So
is it VDSL, the new technology?
It could be. I haven't sussed it out yet because I've been doing a million and one other things, but I'll have a proper look at the technology when I get a chance. We'll be going back to Bournemouth at the bottom of England towards the end of the trip. We stayed in Bournemouth for a few nights with my wife's brother, and he's got a computer there, and he's got a little Wi-Fi router, which was great, that I hooked into, and he's got very fast internet access there. So I'll have a look at it and give you a proper report in a couple of weeks' time.
What's the cost of internet like over there? Have you had a bit of a look-see, or you've just been touristy and using it?
Apart from it being free, it's really good. But if you have to pay for it, it's the same probably like it is anywhere in internet kiosks and motels, probably a pound or a couple of pounds for half an hour or an hour. Just depends on where you go. And if you buy your lunch and your coffees at the same place at the same time, then it tends to subsidise your internet access. But pretty comparable.
Oh, that's good. That's nice to know. We had a listener email us, I think, Brian, you've spoken to him, I think, via the show when you were this side of the planet before, in relation to the BBC and their licensing fees for television and the likes. £139 a year to subsidise the BBC. Have you spoken to anyone about that? Do they is there any grumbles about that, or do they think it's all money well worth spent?
No grumbles. Most people think it's money well spent, and from what I've seen, it's a very good service that the BBC provides. They've got all the television channels in addition to the radio channels. They've got news, which is just non-stop. It's like on BBC One, and they've got programming on the other channels as well. So, yeah, they're also another thing that to mention is that they're turning off analog, I think, sometime in the next 6 months or so. So there'll be no more analog. I was getting questions from some of the family members over here. What do I need to do, Dr. Ron? Do I need to buy a box, or do I need to get a new TV? Because the pressure's on now. They're really starting to turn up the heat when it comes to switching off the analog signal. So that'll be interesting to see how that evolves over the next 6 months or so.
Is there much of a problem with that? Or if everyone just sort of, you know, taking it in their stride?
Everyone's just taking it in their stride. There's not much of a problem because most people have switched over already, like in the last few years. It's just the last of the technophobes, I guess, that are starting to hit the panic button.
Ah, yeah, there's plenty of those people that like to find problems with those with anything, really.
Now, how many digital TV channels are there over there free to air?
I'll find out for you, Graeme. I'll let you know next time we speak.
Cool. And just briefly about the mobile phones, because we'll have to let you go, surely, Dr. Ron, because time is not with us at the moment. You're using third-generation technology. Is it fast with data and that? Have you given it a bit of a run for its money?
I haven't used any data. I am on 3G networks everywhere I go, but I've avoided the data just purely from the cost consideration, and I've just been using Wi-Fi where I've been able to on the PDA. So I haven't given that a go. At the moment, just using the phone for voice.
And that's been working okay. Just obviously, you rang me this evening, your number popped up, so that's really nice to know that it all works across the seas.
It does, yeah, it's really good. It just comes lights up with your name on the phone when you ring, and SMSs are working a treat. They're going backwards and forwards without any problems at all, so it's all very, very seamless. You just hop off the plane, turn the phone on, and you've got coverage, off you go.
Fantastic.
Now, your mobile phone provider did a really good service with the international roaming. You've kept your number. It's not costing you a fortune to make calls while you're overseas, if I understand correctly from what you've said. But they didn't provide you with data roaming of any kind?
They probably have data roaming, Graeme. I've got to do some research on the cost. I'm just a bit wary about accidentally, attaching myself to a partner and roaming with a partner on a 2.5G network, in which case the cost is going to go through the roof. So that's what I'm concerned about there. I might hop on the net a bit later and have a look at some of the prices. But if I can safely guarantee that I'm going to be staying on 3 or whatever the 3 equivalent is over here, and I stay on a 3G network, and I'm not going to get hit with exorbitant data rates, and I could probably use it for data okay.
Tell me about the locals. Do they embrace technology like Australians do? Like, does everybody have a mobile phone? Every young schoolgirl and schoolboy heading to school having a chat on their... Like, I pulled up in front of one of the private schools here in Melbourne, and if I didn't see white cords coming out of young kids' ears and talking on mobile phones with everyone, I'd go, hey, is it the same sort of take-up in Ireland and the UK?
Yeah, it seems to be. Everyone's got a mobile phone, and everyone's got... Everyone swaps their mobile phone number with me when I meet them or catch up with them. And I've never seen as many iPhones as I have over here. It's amazing. Like, it was at the airport, and there's probably 3 or 4 people waiting to collect their bags, and everyone's tapping away and thumbing through all the screens on their iPhones. So, yeah, certainly technology take-up is just as good, if not better, than home, for sure.
Dr. Ron, you know what gift I'd like if you're buying?
I'll see what I can get you through. When we go through customs, JD, I'll see if there's... I had one of our people on Twitter actually ask me if they could pick up a couple of litres of grog, but I said, I'm going to need that for myself just to get through. through the flights, I think I'll be using the full allotment there. I can't help any of our Tech Talk listeners with that. But I'll see what I can do about your iPhone though, JD.
Oh, very good.
Thank you.
You just have to bring back a data plan to go with it. Have you seen any of the data plans over there?
No, I haven't, to be honest. I've just been doing a lot of holiday sightseeing and merrymaking, so I haven't done much of that research. But hopefully I'll have some more details for you next time we speak.
All right. So where to from here? You're up in Northern Ireland. You're going to head south fairly shortly. What's on the cards?
Yeah, in Belfast for 3 days, and then down to Dublin for 4 or 5 days, then heading over to Scotland, Glasgow, Edinburgh, over to Denmark to catch up with Matthew, back to England, and then home. So, yeah, there'll be many more occasions when we'll be able to catch up, and I'll give you a bit more of a sit rep. You can follow me on Twitter as well if you're interested. I'm updating Twitter with updates there. The great thing about Twitter is I can send SMS messages. I don't need internet access to do that, to update that. So that's RK5075, and also keeping the Facebook status updated as well as we go along.
You and your Facebook, so are you feeling happy, grumpy, sad, elated? And, of course, you've got the time difference as well. How's Facebook working mobile-wise?
Ron is feeling jet-lagged. Yeah, no, it's working well and, very fast.
So, heading south. When next week, where will you be around showtime? Any ideas?
I'm guessing either Dublin or possibly Glasgow in Scotland.
Well, that sounds nice and warm. It's nice and warm here at the moment too, just so you know, depending on where you're listening to us from the countryside. So, hey, Dr. Ron, it's been an absolute pleasure, as per normal, having you join us in the... There's a chair here just waiting for you when you come back. So it's been terrific. So thank you, and thank Lainey too for allowing you the time to come and play with us this evening.
All right, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on, and I'll give you another report next week. And looking forward to coming back and sharing all the stories and having a bit of a slide night at some point in time.
Oh, dear. Do we really want a slide night?
Digital slide night.
Yeah, exactly. And you can put those up on Facebook or Twitter or whatever
all
you
that,
do.
All that grogs he's bringing back will help with the slide night.
that's a point, too, and a few Guinnesses, too. Have a Guinness for us, Dr. Ron. It'll be, several Guinnesses for us.
All right, will do, for sure. All right, we'll catch you next week. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Ron. It's been absolutely, wonderful. He's obviously enjoying himself and doing some field research for the program. So, all right, that was Dr. Ron, all the way from, he did something, Blarney, was it? Northern Ireland? Out there in the wild blue yonder on vacation, field researching, tax deductibility, I reckon. That's all he goes for. Anyway, let's briefly, before we close out the program this evening, we're about to go to the Oddspot Gadget and Website of the Week. Just a couple of other interesting things about Google and the UK. Did you know that Google now owns 3/4 of UK search? That's not bad for a small little web browsing company. According to IT News, more than 3/4 of all internet searches are conducted by Google, according to market research firm Comscore. Google sites host 75.3% of all UK search queries during the month of June. So obviously they're fairly big in the UK.
There you go.
That's another string in their bow, I guess. Also, some other interesting gossip, which I think Simon from Symbian was also having a bit of an interest in before. XP is still outselling Vista, according to Hewlett-Packard. Yep. Senior executive at HP said that the sales of the systems of Windows XP still make up the majority of its sales, despite the operating system being officially withdrawn from sale in June. They must have a few copies left over.
There you go. And, quite a lot of equipment around new notebooks and so on. They'll come with Vista, but you can roll them back to XP. Make sure you get the rollback kit when you buy them.
It's very handy. But you can still get it through buying a device. Yep. You can't buy the OEM version or go into a shop and buy XP anymore, can you?
I'm not sure exactly what the rules are, to be honest. I probably should know.
Okay. The iPhone blacklist reported. Now, did you know about this, JD? Apparently, there's blacklist. A little...
I've just been having a read that apparently someone's found a file in the iPhone firmware that supposedly calls home, i.e. Apple.com.
ET phones home, yes.
And says, I've got these applications installed. Which ones do you want me to remove? Or at least that's what they think. But no one's seen it in operation.
But why are they that worried that someone's going to put something on their device that's going to be detrimental to their users?
Like, well, remember the software development kit only came out recently, and before that, no third-party apps were allowed. In fact, there was no mechanism to even get them on there other than by hacking your iPhone with some special software that Apple didn't provide. So it's only recently that you could actually download third-party applications. And in pretty much the same reports, they're talking about two iPhone applications that have been removed from the App Store. One of them we talked about last week, which was NetShare, which allowed you to use your iPhone as a 3G modem for your laptop or desktop.
Do you know
computer.
Why? They just wasn't.
No, there's no real reason that
they just
that
disappeared.
Apple put
did
out.
They
just disappeared off the list?
Is it possible that something like that might be a feature they're wanting to put in officially rather than have as a third party app?
It could well be. Although Apple in the past have bought out third party developer software. So, for example, Windows Shade used to be an application on the old Mac operating system. Apple just bought it and installed it as part of their operating system. So,
right.
a bit That's like Microsoft. Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Listening to Tech Talk Radio. We'll be back with the closing moments of the show after this.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening. You're listening.
Residual powers. And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
You're listening.
In terms of the volume,
I understand to give fingerprints. Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk Radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometers.
Don't open
per
things that are as good as you're not expecting, even if they do a thing like it.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my own!
This week's Gadget of the Week is for those people who've got more things attached to their computers than they know where to put. It's a specially designed gaming table with space for no less than three 21-inch LCD monitors, your flight control yokes, your joysticks and pedals, and yep, everything attaches
That's
to this
exactly
table.
What you need.
There's even room for a keyboard somewhere over there to the left.
And the computer itself somewhere?
Yeah, the computer itself must go somewhere. I can't see it in the photograph here, but yeah.
Just bury him in the back these days,
yeah,
don't you?
Everything, joysticks, monitors.
A gaming
flight
table.
Flight control yoke. It's a gaming table. It comes from Digital Edge, and you can find it on their website. It goes in America for $379.
Gee, that's cheap.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get any of the actual hardware, any of the controls
with it. You don't expect
it,
you just want a place to put your monitors.
It's a really fancy table that puts everything right where right at your fingertips where you need it. Yeah, it did. It's obviously specialised for those people that are heavily into game, more so than I am anyway.
So how much was it?
379 US from Digital Edge.
Not bad. All right, there you go. If you've got want a gaming table, there's the one for you.
There's the one.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Well, we had to have Google's Maps this week for the Tech Talk Radio website of the week. If you haven't had a look at it, go and do it now. maps.google.com.au.
And the big feature to look for, of course, is the Australian street views that have just been added.
Well, that's right. So you go there, you put your little address, put your home address in there, in that little bar at the top there.
Yep.
Funnily enough, they know where you live. Now you can come down and have a look at your house from the satellite, but you'll notice there's a little button on the top right-hand corner says Street View. You click on Street View, it opens up a little black window in front of you, and lo and behold, theoretically, there should be your house, except if you live in some parts of Camberwell and other parts of Melbourne, and there's, I think, a few other places around the countryside where it's not seen.
Depends a bit on where you live, but anywhere, if you're looking at Google Maps, anywhere where the streets have got little blue lines down the side, that's where that's where the Street View camera has been. maps.google.com.au.
Yeah, so go and have a look now. It's very entertaining. Go and spy on your neighbours.
There is a fine line between genius and madness. Shoot.
Missed it by that much. I know nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Yes, everybody's getting in on it these days. Another person putting their life up for sale on eBay is what I'm
Not
talking
another
about.
One.
Absolutely. This time it's an English lord.
Oh.
Dr. Ron could go and visit him, do an interview while he's over there. What do you think?
Good.
An eccentric British millionaire has put his life up for sale on the internet, including his title of the Lord of the Manor of Worley, in the hope of converting his assets into cash. That's what you need, a cash-strapped Lord.
Yeah, well, there's probably a few of them about these days.
Are there? Why? What makes you say that?
So you get to pay money to take over his mortgage.
Is that what it is?
I don't know.
I don't know. That's a
something like that.
You can come and pay money to take over my mortgage if you like. I'm more than happy for that.
I'll be able to do a swap with him.
Absolutely. David Piper, a hotelier who made headlines 6 years ago after advertising for a wife to become his lady of the manor, wants to sell his West of England existence on auction site eBay and move to London to be closer to his children. Why not? He's selling two hotels, two Bentleys, a collection of paintings, and his title of the Lord of the Manor, which he bought along with a large estate for £1 million. You're all speechless, aren't you?
Mm.
Absolutely. That's what it
How
is.
How much would you expect to pay? $10,000, so you can do it in PayPal.
I don't know. More than 100 bids have been received so far, with the current offer standing at around £1.3 million. Bidding closes on August the 11th, which is today. Right. Quick, get in.
Hurry
quick,
up. Yep.
Go. Go, run, bid. All right, you've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron from Remote in the studio this evening has been Graham Callaghan, Justin Dunlop, and myself, Andrew McCommon. And join us next week, where we'll do similar things all over again. So that's been Tech Talk. Thanks for listening to us in your iPod, wherever you are in the radio, driving around in the city. You never know. All right, until next week, it's bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.